Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So this talk is about a simple idea for growing interesting quantum many body states, starting with small molecules. It's an idea for that. And we're going to think about, I'm going to try to argue that it's possible. And then we're going to think about consequences of the fact that that's possible. And then we're going to try to persuade someone to actually do it. That part hasn't happened yet. This is the sort of basis of a program that I've been working on with Brian Swingle for the past little while, which we started calling S Sorcery. You'll see what the S means in a moment. It's an index that it's a label that we can put on states of matter, which is good. The bad thing about it is that the S stands for source, it's kind of unfortunate, but we can't stop calling it that now. And I'm particularly happy to be talking about this here, both at this workshop and at PI, because partly because the whole thing is sort of based on ideas from cosmology and quantum gravity that we're applying to condensed matter physics. So it's really, you know, at the first one of these workshops, I talked about it was kind of backwards. I was talking about using ideas from condensed matter physics to do high energy physics. I was talking about like new anomalies in field theory. But here I'm really following the program going in the right direction of from high energy to low energy. And the other reason is that Brian and I started working on this here sometime in the distant past. And maybe it was at the first version of your workshop. I don't remember. So the plan is we're going to try to apply this machinery to first to states with a gap, where the things I'm saying will really be true, and I can even prove it to. And then I'm going to, you know, a lot of our effort has been devoted to trying to show that this way of thinking about the world also extends to those interesting parts of the world where there isn't an energy gap. And then most recently, we've been thinking about applying it to not just pure states, which whoever encounters a pure quantum state, but to mixed states, open quantum systems. And so lest anybody is confused about the agenda here, let me start by saying that from some point of view, the sort of big goal of what we're doing is to understand the structure of entanglement in physical states of quantum field theories, not just relativistic ones, but quantum systems with degrees of freedom that you can smear on your toast. And what I mean by physical states here, this is a very important word here, because as probably everybody knows by now, Hilbert space is this vast green ocean that extends in all directions off of the page. And only in this tiny little corner here, so by Hilbert space here, I mean the Hilbert space of a quantum many-body system, where there's some thermodynamically large number of local Hilbert spaces tensioned together. And this little corner, this little sliver here, is all the states you'll ever see in your life, either in the real world or in simulations or anywhere else, and I guess here's mean field theory. Maybe the mean field theory should extend to some part of the part that you won't see. That's product states there, and so a big part of the job, I would say, my job as I don't know whatever the heck it is I do, is to try to understand where this corner of Hilbert or whatever shape it has, to figure out what shape that corner of Hilbert space has and where it is. And this is, of course, an important thing if we actually want to identify the wave function for some kind of such quantum many-body system, because, as I'm sure you all know, storing the wave function in an arbitrary point in this space is not something that we have enough atoms in the universe to do. And so we need to know where to look and how to parameterize the wave function before looking for it. And secondly, this way of thinking about the world in terms of the entanglement between its constituents is extremely useful as a way to distinguish phases of matter, which may not be distinguished in more traditional boring ways, such as their breakings of symmetries. And this is a lovely picture that Thurin Grover made of the kind of way in which this happens. Maybe I'll say one more about that. And then finally, I guess this is my this is the part of my talk that's about holography. This is a crucial point of contact between our best understanding of quantum gravity and this study of quantum many-body systems. So in the sense that to our best current understanding, the areas of regions in space-times which emerge by holographic duality are connected with the entanglement entropy of those regions in the dual state. And I guess maybe I should say areas of regions that of spaces that emerge. Because when time is emergent, the story is more interesting. Maybe I'll comment about that at the end. Okay, so that's the motivation. Here's the context. So let's imagine that someone hands you a Hilbert space, which is a tensor product of some local Hilbert spaces. Here's a picture of that. So each of these little things here is some Hilbert space, and they're tensored together. There's a Hamiltonian which couples them together, and its important properties are that it's local. So the little chunks of sod only talk to their neighbors, or maybe their next nearest neighbors, not too far away. The support of each of these terms is localized. And let's assume furthermore that there is a Hamiltonian motif. So that is, there's some pattern in the Hamiltonian that repeats. You can't have some like special part of the system, which where you know there's like a water feature or something. None of that. And this is actually very important because there are lots of counterexamples to the things I'm going to say. If I allow you to have some special place where you like connect everybody to everyone else, and you can do whatever you want. Okay, so this is a pretty pretty general class of physical systems, I think we'll all agree. And I'm going to make one more assumption, which is that I'm going to assume that I'm going to allow myself the notion of families of such systems labeled by the linear size. So that is, I imagine I have, say, one of these Hamiltonians with, say, periodic boundary conditions with a system with a torus with length L on a side, so there's some collection of ground states of the Hamiltonian on that system size, and I'm going to imagine that the existence of such a thing for every L, so families of systems. That's not too strong an assumption, I think. Okay, so here's a thing which is impossible, but which I would like. No, I guess I don't want it to be true, because then you could prove 0 = 1 and stuff like that. So here's a thing which maybe someone might want if they were naive, namely. Imagine starting with just a collection of decoupled product qubits, right? The kind of qubits that you could just buy at the grocery store. You just tensor them together, and you act with that, act on those qubits with a unitary operator, which is some low depth circuit. So something that looks like this, something where here's the product state that I'm acting on, and I act, action of operators goes, say, up. I act on it with this circuit. Each qubit is only acted on by like two of these gates. That's what I mean by low depth. And from that, voila, I could imagine producing the ground state of this system at size L. What do you think? Wouldn't that be great?
So the finding would be by low depth?
Low depth, yeah. But the depth of such a circuit is something like, you look at a single one of these bits and ask how many gates do you have to go through to get to the output?
To
each of these little blocks, it's a unitary that acts on some finite number of qubits at a time. So really, really what I mean by low depth is that it doesn't grow at the system size. So some order L to the zero thing. So this is impossible, but let's think about a case where it is possible for just a second, just to see, why this might be desirable. So here's a warm-up example, which I'm going to teach you to think of. I'm going to teach you to call this D = 1, S = 0. So at the end of the lecture, everybody will be all slicked up with my jargon. Let's think about a band insulator. Here's a picture of a one-dimensional band insulator, and these blue lines represent some hopping for some, say, free fermion. This is its Hamiltonian. The fermion can hop from one of these sites to the next. And let's imagine it's fully filled. So it's just an insulator. You fill the band, nobody moves, and there's a gap. Okay, so now something I can do to this is I can vary the strength of the hopping on every other bond. So I make this one stronger and this one weaker. And I do that, I vary this parameter eta from 0 to 1, so that by the time eta gets to 1, the system looks like this. And I can do that preserving the gap the whole time. The band is always completely filled. And when I get here, the system is obviously just a bunch of molecules, right? The fermions just, you know, sit here. These fermions are not entangled with those fermions at all. They don't even know they're there. And that is a product state, right? So the ground state of this Hamiltonian is an example of these kinds of qubits that you can buy at the grocery store. And so in this example, we really can do this in general impossible thing, which is starting from this product state. Let's imagine, so here I'm running this arrow backwards. Starting from this product ground state, so this ground state of the thing with eta equals 1, I can adiabatically vary this parameter eta. Adiabatically meaning I do it slowly enough that I remain in the ground state the whole time. And because the gap is independent of the system size, slowly enough means that the time that I have to do that for doesn't grow at the system size. And then if you imagine taking this adiabatic evolution operator, time evolution operator, and doing some like Trotter Suzuki kind of thing to chop it up into a circuit, the depth of the circuit is related to the time, the duration of the time interval that you have to do it for. And you get, and this produces such a circuit. Okay, so this would be this is a simple way to create a machine which constructs from basically nothing, from free qubits which are all around us. Okay, I'll try to argue for that point of view in a little more. Free qubits which are all around us, this thing produces the ground state that we want of this Hamiltonian. Okay, so why do I say that this is impossible? There are two reasons that there are two problems with trying to do this in general as a way to instantly construct the ground state of an arbitrary quantum many-body system. The first problem is a purely technical obstacle, which some of you may have realized, that even if our instantaneous Hamiltonians have a gap, even if the gap is constant and bounded below by some system size independent thing, the adiabatic evolution has some non-zero failure probability per unit time, per unit volume, right? So in a quantum many-body system, in a large system, that means that there's a growing probability for failure. And so we may not end up in the ground state, even if we start in the ground state and do it arbitrarily slowly. But this has a solution, which was developed by Hastings and also Wen. And that solution is in this gray box, and I don't really want to talk about it too much. But it's basically a filtering procedure where you modify the Hamiltonian that you evolved by to filter out the low energy modes, to filter out the parts that would produce the transitions to excited states. And the cost for that filtering, or the benefit of the filtering, is that you exactly evolve from the ground state to the ground state. And the cost for that filtering is that you lose a little bit of locality. So that is the range of the circuit, the size of the little blocks that you get when you trotterize it, are a little bigger. In particular, they have to grow with the system size a little bit, like logs. If there's a gap, it grows like logs. So this is a gray technical box, which I'm going to use later, but it's not sort of it's not the crucial thing. So instead of adiabatic evolution, we do quasi-adiabatic evolution, which is exact but not exactly local. Okay, and then the other problem is really a physical crucial obstruction, which is that different states of matter are distinguished from each other, at least when there's a gap, by the fact that you can't adiabatically evolve from one to the other. That is, here I have a gapped phase of matter. I can't, in order to reach a Hamiltonian, which is in a different phase, at some point the gap has to close, right? That's what it means for it to be a different phase, and so clearly I can't just do that. And so here comes the idea for getting around this, for achieving something that's very much like this big red U here, but in a way which is actually possible in general, which is that instead of starting with just product states, instead of just going to the supermarket and buying a big bag of product states, we go to the supermarket and we buy a molecule of the system that we want, right? So it's like seeds. Someday at the supermarket they'll have rows where you can buy like transfer field Ising model or fermionic Hubbard model, and they give you a little system size L bag of it, where L is some like four sites, and then you bring it home and you take your okay, sorry. I can't keep it up. Okay. So the idea is to grow the system, starting with the small molecule. And instead of doing this quasi-adiabatic evolution to make the whole thing at once, we do that evolution to double the system size. So starting with the system at some tiny initial size, this little arrow is meant to indicate that we do that procedure I was just advocating, but only to double the system size rather than to grow the whole thing at once. And so the big red U that we make is actually not finite depth, but rather each of these has finite depth. So if you want to make a macroscopic system, the number of these you need is something like the log of the system size. But so that's the price. The fact that it's not finite depth, but rather has slow growth with system size, is the price for actually being able to do it. And the benefit of this picture is that it'll have an RG structure. That is, the short distance physics will be here, and then you'll get to the long distance physics at the end. And the picture I want you to have in mind is really that what we're doing is taking this tiny system and putting it in an expanding universe. Okay, so the role of the expanding universe is the background geometry is growing, and that's what is causing this evolution by these unitaries. I'll say a little more about that. Okay, so the assumption I'm making, which I guess I maybe already kind of revealed, is that there's a freely available bath of these product qubits initialized in some reference state, which we can just take take for free. And as I said, if there's a gap, I can actually say things that are rigorous. And if the Hamiltonians I'm talking about have a ground state degeneracy, it's important. I'm going to assume that those ground states are locally indistinguishable. So that is that there's no operator that mixes them. There's no local operator that mixes them, because if there were, then I would just add that to the Hamiltonian, and we wouldn't be talking about the degeneracy. So that is, any ground state degeneracy is a consequence of some topological order or something interesting. Yes, please.
So you're still starting from a product state?
Well, no, right. So I guess I should have written an equation. So this is an equation for the unitary operator, which grows the system. Actually, you have to start with, maybe I have a... So the state we want at size L is this big red U, this is red, acts on the ground state at size L naught. So imagine L naught is like 4. Sorry, this is not quite true, because I need to tensor with lots and lots of ancillas. Right, so that this is a unitary, this has to take a state in this Hilbert space to a state in the same Hilbert space. And so this thing is like 4 sites big, right? It's something you even I could exactly diagonalize. I guess that's not really what you need to buy at the store, because you can do that with Mathematica. Yeah. Okay. So, but here's the picture, maybe a little more clearly. So here I'm going to describe the construction of a single one of these factors, right? So something that takes system size L to system size 2L. So imagine we know somehow, either because we just did exact idealization or because we've done the procedure log L times already, that we know the ground state of the Hamiltonian that we want on system size L. So in one dimension, that's a row of L bits there, which are already entangled with each other, right? Entangled as much as the Hamiltonian wants them to be in their ground state. And then we go to the supermarket and buy these, we take for free these qubits here, these blue ancilla qubits, which are just in a tensor product state initially, and we imagine intercalating, that's a vocabulary word, them in between these already entangled qubits. And what I mean by that is we construct a path in the space of Hamiltonians where we slowly turn off these interactions, the interactions that that these guys would have because they're neighbors, and turn on interactions between this guy and this guy because they're becoming neighbors. Right, so in order to show that a Hamiltonian, a family of Hamiltonians, participates in this program, we have to find a gapped path in the space of Hamiltonians from the Hamiltonian which is the H sub L plus the Hamiltonian which initializes this qubit in this product state to the Hamiltonian of size H2L, of size 2L, and then this relation holds. And this U L to 2L is constructed by quasi adiabatic evolution. Okay, so.
Sorry,
yes, please.
Maybe one naive question, which is, it seems like you could have arbitrary phases for all of these little blue dots.
You're asking what state I put the blue dots in?
Yeah.
You're right. There's an arbitrary choice for what state I put them in. But if I put them in a different state, I would need a different evolution operator to get from here to here.
Okay, so the fact that I can have arbitrary phases there means that the family
of different.
Well, I guess, yeah, maybe the good way to think about it is there's a sort of equivalence relation from the point of view of studying interesting entangled quantum antibody states, which is that two states which are related by just a unitary on a single site are kind of the same, right? In the sense that that's something I imagine, you know, someone sitting at that one site could turn a knob and do it. And so we'd like to sort of mod out by that complication. Yeah. But you're right, there is freedom there. Think of it as, you know, we're choosing a basis for this Hilbert space, for that on-site Hilbert space. Good. All right, so here's a definition. So what I meant by participate in our program here is a system for which we can construct the ground state on at system size 2L, linear size 2L, by this procedure, by acting on the ground state at system size L, plus these unentangled ancillas, using such a quasi-local unitary, we're going to call an S-source fixed point. That's what we called it. And notice that in order for that to happen, we need the right number of ancillas here, so that these numbers add up to the same dimension. There was a question? Oh, okay. And so previously I drew the example in one dimension. In two dimensions, doubling the system size means doubling it in both directions, right? So if I start with two sites in this direction and one site in this direction, I need to add, you know, that many blue qubits to get the 4x2 system. And as I said, the way to construct the Hamiltonian, one layer of this construction is by quasi-adiabatic evolution. So we just have to find a gapped path in the space of Hamiltonians from here, from the ground state at size L plus the qubits to the ground state at size 2L. And then we use this filtering procedure that I briefly sketched. Okay, so what I meant by we're gonna think about the consequences of the existence, of the possibility of doing this is the following. So the first immediate thing is that if a family of Hamiltonians participates in our program, then it immediately satisfies recursion relations for the entropy, for the entanglement entropy of subregions, which is that the difference between the entanglement entropy of a region of size R and the entanglement entropy of a region of size 2R necessarily only differs by the stuff you added. It necessarily only differs by the entanglement created by this evolution from size L to size 2L. There's some powerful theorems which show that means that there's this area law behavior. That is, the difference goes like the one R to the D minus 1, where D is the number of spatial dimensions. And this S here, this green S, I guess this is the first time it appeared, is, I should have emphasized it when I introduced this definition, I'm allowing for the possibility that we might not be able to do this procedure starting with a single copy of the system. So that is, it may be that there's some very, very strongly entangled ground states where, in order to make the system at size 2L, you need to start with not just a single copy of the system at size L, but more than one, and that number is called S. S is for source. Okay, and there are some examples where that happens.
Yes. Question. So the fact that you're doubling these systems, what's so special about two?
Nothing. Okay. Yeah, we could put a lot.
Couldn't you make that number very, very large, which would seem like a hundredfold or something, where you have this tiny sort of seed, I guess, and then all of these sort of independent zeros?
Okay, yeah, you're right. So two and 100 are the same, but two and something that grows with system size are not the same, right? So you know what I mean? So the question is the parametric dependence on the system size. And if at some point, you know, if the factor by which we grow the system is too big, then we'll have trouble finding this gap path, right? That is the gap will want to close in the middle. And that's what will enforce, you know, the difference between the difference of the phases. Okay, good. All right, so why is this a useful idea? So there are a few reasons. One is that recursion relation I just mentioned immediately shows that any state which has S less than or equal to 1 in D bigger than 1 immediately satisfies the area law for the entanglement of subregions. So that is, the entanglement entropy of a subregion necessarily only grows like the linear size to the d minus 1. And to violate the area law, in fact, in d dimensions, you need s to be bigger than 2 to the d minus 1. So that's just a consequence of solving this recursion relation. Assume it's saturated and solve it. Mathematica can solve it.
Can you show again what s is?
Yeah, so s is the number of copies of the ground state of size L that you need to double the system size.
What is s less than 1?
Well, so an example. So actually, the only example I've showed you has s equals 0. So that is, s equals 0 means you don't need any copies. You can just start with product states.
Yes.
Right? You can make it from nothing. Yeah, so s. Yeah, that's what s equals 0 means. And you can ask if fractional s makes sense, and that actually does make sense, because you can imagine that you need 2 copies to make 3 or something like that. Yeah. Okay.
Question.
Yes, please.
So the new degrees of freedom, are they always interleaved between the ones you already have?
Well, it's very important that we're sort of entangling them locally, right? Because that's the reason we can apply this notion of small incremental entangling. Yeah, so when we couple them in, we're coupling them by a local Hamiltonian. That's right. So it's not like crystal growth in that sense where, it doesn't just grow at the surface. It grows, everywhere in between the sites. It's like the expanding universe. Okay.
Interleaving is a property of U.
It's a property of U. Certainly. I mean, that's the construction, right? Yeah. That I'm imagining. Yeah. So by interleaving, I mean this. Yeah. This business intercalating. I think, and maybe interleaving is pretty good too. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the reason we can use this small incremental entangling theorem. Okay, so if there is a ground state degeneracy, it automatically satisfies this relation, which, as you can see, means that s bigger than 1 and a ground state degeneracy implies a very rapid growth of the ground state degeneracy with system size, which is weird. Next, the smallest possible s is a property of the phase. The reason it's a property of the phase is that property of the phase is something which is invariant under adiabatic deformations, and it's sort of by definition that. And so this S is a classification axis. Right? We can label states by this S. I'll say more about that in a second. And then finally, probably most usefully, I guess I'm making a prediction about the future there. A reason to care about this is that the existence of this unitary evolution implies a mera representation of the ground state, as I'll describe in a little more detail in a moment. Okay, so but before saying anything else about that, as I mentioned, the only example I've shown you so far is s equals 0. So product states, mean field symmetry breaking states, and band insulators have s equals 0. You can make them from nothing. Most interesting ground states that you read about on the Condensed Matter Archive have s equals 1. And I guess I should emphasize that this includes some states for which people have had a hard time constructing efficient representations for their ground, efficient representations, such as, So as a building block, the integer quantum Hall state has s equals 1, and the reason I know this is that we can start with a lattice model of the integer quantum Hall state, like the Hofstadter model. And so this is a picture of two unit cells of the square lattice, and I'm imagining that these blue dots are being added upon the doubling of the system size. And so I'm going to turn off, maybe I should. Oh, I can show you a movie. Let me show you a movie. That'll be better. Okay. I was supposed to have found the movie before. That would have been a good idea. My apologies for the technical difficulties. This is an interesting paper by Sohn, by the way. Okay, there we go. So this is a picture of what I'm doing. Start with the square lattice. This is actually, I'm doing it backwards. Start with the square lattice with this many sites. Turn on the interactions between these two. it's going too fast for me to narrate. So the red dots are the degrees of freedom that I'm intercalating in. The opacity of the lines is related to the strength of the interactions between them. And so you see in this way we're doubling the system size at each step. Yeah. Okay, and so if I do this procedure in the right way, it involves a little bit of cleverness to make that happen. I can make it so that the gap, so these are the bands. These are the bands of that lattice model that I just described. There's four bands because, how does it go? Because that's the right number. The churn numbers of these bands are indicated here. The middle, these guys have churn numbers 1 and minus 1. So if I imagine I put the thing at half filling, so I've filled the bottom two, you can see that the gap between these two, it's not enormous, but it stays non-zero for the whole history. And this evolution of the bands is what the bands do as the previous movie runs, as the interactions vary according to the previous movie. Okay, so you can see that we can double the system size of a churn insulator adiabatically, right? So this is a proof that such a thing has S equals 1. Okay. I don't know why it assumes that you want to see it really small. That's a strange assumption. Okay, and then... other folks have showed that it's possible to make a similar construction for discrete gauge theory. And by combining these two ingredients, we can make a construction for fractional quantum Hall states, for even chiral quantum Hall states like lattice versions of the Laughlin state. So all these things have S equals 1. And then more generally, I guess all at once, any gapped field theory, any field theory you can write a Lagrangian for, where it has a mass, has a mass gap, and couple it to curved space. So this, in my mind, this is any field theory that actually exists, has S equals 1 because, get ready for it, you can put it in an expanding universe. Right? And because there's a gap, like think about a massive scalar field, right? The instantaneous gap of the Hamiltonian for a massive scalar field on a time slice of FRW, a sphere, has a gap, right? And so it has a gap for each system size, and you can adiabatically and then quasi-adiabatically follow its ground state evolution in the expanding universe. And that's a proof that it has S equals 1, right? So somehow that expanding universe is producing these free qubits. Right, and you know, this happened. So, like the field theory that we're made of, experienced it's living in an expanding universe. The system size has doubled over the past however many billion years, and you know the QCD gap stayed open during that time. The pion is massive. The proton is massive, and this is an experimental demonstration of a gapped path from system size L, which is, I don't know, the size associated with the QCD phase transition, to system size 2L, which is where we are now. And so, so QCD has S equals 1. And maybe there could be advantages to this alternative suggestion for alternative route to finding to simulating its ground state relative to lattice Monte Carlo. And a reason that that might be a good idea is, for example, if you're interested in finite baryon density, where there's a sign problem from Monte Carlo. So maybe this is a useful experimental observation. Let me pause for a moment to emphasize to everyone how weird it is that there is this bath of free Ancilla qubits everywhere that come in from the ultraviolet and entangle themselves into the ground state of the field theory that we're living in. It's just a fact. I don't know where they come from. It's true. Okay, yes, please.
I wonder if this goes against a known fact that it's the entropy is a very good conserved in a moving body. So obviously, it's not the entropy, the area scaling, it's just the normal thermodynamic entropy that still can be a nice measure of the number of degrees of freedom. So you keep producing degrees of freedom, but the entropy stays the same.
Well, that's so actually, the fact that you're saying is completely consistent with what I'm saying, because I'm saying that it stays in the ground state the whole time. Right, the entropy would be zero. Now, of course, as you're pointing out, this is not in fact true, because there is some small excitation above the ground state, like you and me, and a thermal, cosmic microwave background. You're right, so it really is at finite temperature. I hope to say something about applications of these ideas to mixed states in just a moment. But no, but that's exactly consistent. The entropy is conserved. It's adiabatic evolution, right? That's the thing I'm using. So if it were in the ground state, it would stay in the ground state. And it starts in some small excited state. It stays in some small excited state. There aren't that many pions, though, right? And there's some cosmic rays, but there's not. Yeah. Okay. I'm joking a little bit, but it's actually true. It's really true. Okay, so this S is a classification axis. I told you it's a property of a phase. And so here's a picture of the world. This is the world of gapped states. In between here, 0 and 1, is field theory, right? Because I said field theory is something that you can put on an expanding universe, and therefore it has S equals 1. Did I do something? No. OK. S between 1 and and 2 to the d minus 1 is not, there are examples, but they're pretty weird. So the two examples I can tell you about, one is layers of fractional quantum Hall states. That's kind of cheating because they're not coupled, they're not entangled with each other. So that's something which has S equals something bigger than one. And a more interesting example is Ha's cubic code, which Ha himself showed has S equals two, that you need two copies of the state of system size L to double the system size. And he explicitly constructed the circuit. It's amazing. So this is a proof that is a quantum many body system, a gap quantum many body system, that has no field theory description. There's no low energy field theory for that system. It's weird. Okay, and then bigger than 2 to the d minus 1 violates the area law. Right at 2 to the d minus 1, you get a logarithmic violation of the area law, which it's not a Fermi surface because I'm talking about gapped systems, but we'll get to that in just a second. And then bigger than that, you can rule out by some very reasonable assumptions. So that's the world. And so here's the reason. Here's the best reason to care, is that it makes a mirror. And what's a mirror? I guess it's a little embarrassing to talk about this here, just very quickly, it's something that allows it. It's a circuit, a tensor network representation of the state, which not only is a nice representation of it, but it's one which allows efficient computation of observables. So unlike, say, some other acronyms, which I won't, I don't want to cast aspersions, you can actually efficiently compute things with it. And moreover, it organizes the information scale by scale, like we were instructed to do by our elders. And it geometrizes the structure of entanglement. It's a picture of some version of the dual geometry, or maybe it's kinematic space or something. It's good. And so why do I say that the existence of the circuit implies such a thing? It's because each of these layers of my circuit, this U which doubles the system size, itself can be trotterized to a low-depth circuit. And so that's some picture like this, where this L is the size of the blocks in the circuit. And that's the thing which has to grow a little bit with system size if we wanted an exact overlap with the ground state because of this quasi-adiabatic evolution.
Sure.
Yes, please.
So up to this slide, I wasn't sure what
word
you were using, but what is trotterize?
So trotterize is it's a verbification of a person named Trotter. Uh-huh. That's too efficient a way to say it. So you know how you derive the path integral?
Yeah.
Right? You insert lots of resolutions of the identity in between things. You do that backwards. Yeah, so it's a proxy. Yeah, it's one more. So. Some people call it Trotter Suzuki is a slightly better way to do it. Treader Suzuki eyes. It's, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the crucial point of this is that is that in this way, if you imagine constructing this S-sorcery circuit, can be sort of blocked into a mirror. And an interesting thing about that is that it's a way to construct a mirror which required no variational sweeping over the system. So that is, you just buy the seed, you buy the molecule at the store, or do exact analyzation for a few sites, and then find the unitary which doubles the size, and then do it over and over again. And I say this as if it's easy, but we've been trying to do it, and I don't know if it works yet. So this is a picture in one dimension. The picture in two dimensions is a little more complicated. You have to just kind of glue together these regions, and this is really just a picture of the Trotter Suzuki. I shouldn't say more about that. Not Suzuki, Trotter. Yeah. Okay. So how am I doing on time? I have 15 minutes left. Is that right? Okay. Okay. So a further payoff of this way of thinking about the world is that it leads us to a robust notion of short-range entangled states. So this is a word which means different things on different coasts of this continent. I live on the west coast of this continent. And so what I mean by it is the following. A state is invertible if it has an inverse, which means that there's another state which has the property that you can make the product of those two states from nothing with a short depth circuit, with one of these big red U's, so that is the product of psi and its inverse. There exists, psi is invertible if psi inverse exists such that the product has S equals zero. And a fact that follows from this picture is that if you have a system with a unique ground state on any closed manifold, that is there's no topological order, but it could still have some edge modes, then it implies the existence of such an inverse state, and also it implies the area law. So here's a picture of that proof. Here's why. So the system on a sphere has a unique ground state. That's my assumption, that it has a unique ground state in a closed manifold. The sphere is made by taking two hemispheres and gluing them together at the equator. Right? Think of this as, there could be some edge modes here, but when we glue them together, they go away so that we end up with a unique ground state. And this whole thing, by squishing it, there's a gap so I can squish it, is two copies of the system, which may have edge states, but this proves that the edge states can be removed. And so this the Hamiltonian for the lower hemisphere is the inverse. So this shows that there's a way to get rid of edge states. That's what this shows. And then the second step, so here we only use the uniqueness of the ground state on the sphere, which is true even if there is topological order in general. But now, imagine taking two copies of the system, so the Hamiltonian plus its inverse, and putting them on top of each other, like this. And now imagine creating lots of tiny little wormholes in between them. And I'm doing this adiabatically, and then I let the wormholes grow. So from the point of view of one of the copies of the system, this is each of these things is a bubble of nothing, right? So a bubble of nothing is a dangerous thing that, for example, Witten showed. It's a way in which the Kaluza-Klein vacuum of gravity on a circle can destroy itself. It's from the point of view of someone living on this copy of the world, each of these things is a hole in the world that there's nothing. Look, there's nothing. But the reason I'm talking to you about it now is because given our assumptions, there's a unique ground state of the system on each of these pictures, and here, when the wormholes are really small, it's the same. It's H plus H inverse, and here at the end, it's just a bunch of molecules. All right. So this is the bubbles of nothing percolate, and the ground state of that thing is just a product state. And so this shows from these assumptions that the inverse state exists, and it satisfies the area law because it participates in this evolution to nothing. Okay. Whew. So all that was about gap states. Many of the interesting questions about the structure of entanglement in the world are about states without an energy gap. And very briefly, combining this picture with some notion of entanglement thermodynamics. I guess different people have different notions of what entanglement thermodynamics is. I'll say what I mean in a second. We can constrain the violations of the area law by gapless states and relate this exponent, this index S, to thermodynamic exponents, in particular to the hyperscaling violating exponent of a gapless critical state. And secondly, we can give examples of, let's say, S source constructions for critical points. So to show that the ideas also extend to gapless states, examples. Okay, so the area law, it's a law, which means that it's sometimes not true, it's sometimes broken, and in particular, it's violated in ground states of metals by this logarithmically growing factor. And why does this happen? It happens because a metal has lots of low energy modes, which not only are low energy modes, which are extended in space, right? And so the fluctuations of those modes entangle the degrees of freedom at the two ends of the support of the wave function. The existence of these low energy modes can be seen in thermodynamics, right? So, for example, I won't remind you about the heat capacity of a metal, but it doesn't decay very quickly with temperature as you lower the temperature. So we showed that if we make an assumption about the temperature dependence of the entropy, the thermodynamic entropy, really the thermodynamic, so this is the usual formula familiar to holographers everywhere for the scaling of the entropy density with the temperature in a system with dynamical exponent z, so time scales with z powers of space, and hyperscaling violating exponent theta. So theta is like some as if there were extra dimensions. So with these assumptions, the ground state entanglement entropy obeys the area law as long as theta is less than d minus 1, and the dynamical exponent is finite. So a Fermi surface is one, it has the property that theta is exactly d minus 1, and that's logarithmically violates the area law. Okay, so maybe I won't tell you exactly why this is true, but I'll tell you the idea for how we know it's true. The idea is to recast the entanglement entropy of a subregion, recast the reduced density matrix of a subregion as a thermodynamics problem, as a thermodynamics problem where there's a local temperature. So this is a trick that's, I guess it's very familiar in some precincts. So for example, for conformal field theory, this is an exact statement that the reduced density matrix of a, at least for subregions of the right shape, is a thermal state where the temperature varies with position. But it's true also more generally, and I guess more precisely we can bound the entanglement entropy of a subregion in terms of the entanglement entropy of such a local Gibbs state, in terms of such a state with a spatially varying temperature. And the reason such a thing exists is just by defining this thing to be the maximum entropy state consistent with observations in the region, and such a thing by Lagrange multipliers automatically has the form of a local Gibbs state. Okay, but then the crucial extra piece of information is this notion of that for scaling purposes, for purposes of analyzing the dependence of these quantities on the size of subregions, we can brutally approximate the actual expectation value of the Hamiltonian in this state as just integrate, you figure out the local temperature, figure out what the energy density would be if that were the temperature, and then you integrate that. Right, so this is like a coarse graining. And for purposes of scaling, this is correct. And here's why. It's in a gray box, don't read it. Okay, and so from this assumption, with a small clever little trick, we can prove the thing I said. And the reason that I display this trick, which I guess this is maybe a little technical for having only 7 minutes left in the talk. The reason I draw this picture is because with this little clever trick, we can show by matching not only the leading terms in this expansion in the shape of this region. We choose some special region. We're trying to show some intrinsic properties, so we can choose the shape of the region to our advantage. By looking at the scaling with the aspect ratio of this this geometry, we can show this that by matching the calculation in terms of this. Local thermodynamics, and in terms of this S-source calculation, so suppose that this ground state were an S-source fixed point with S equals S, with S-sorcery index equals S, then in order to match those two calculations, S has to be 2 to the theta. So this relates this how many copies of this gapless system you need to grow it into this hyperscaling violating exponent.
John,
yes, please.
So I'm saying that in terms of breaking down adiabaticity, is that what is that saying about theta?
Well, okay, yeah. So adiabaticity, right? Clearly, the strategy I was using in the first part of the talk for gapped states of trying to do adiabatic evolution is I don't know how to do that if there isn't a gap, right? Then I don't have an adiabatic theorem. Right, it's. Yeah, somehow it's saying that if I start with this many copies, then I kind of can do that. But how to see that otherwise, I don't know. Yeah. This is an important question. There's some sense in which it's true that this rescues the adiabaticity. So far, I haven't said anything about, here I had to assume that this thing was an S-source fixed point. How do I know that that ever happens? So we found some examples explicitly constructible gapless states where they have S equals 1. And the class of examples that we used are, I don't know, I call them square root states. Maybe other people have other names. It's kind of a famous construction. The earliest reference I could find is this paper by Kimball, which is a machine which takes a classical statistical mechanics model, so some Gibbs ensemble, e to the minus beta h, associated with some classical configurations, and turns it into a ground state of a quantum many-body system where the configurations of the classical system correspond to some orthogonal bases of states of the quantum system. So think about for each configuration of spins, ionizing spins up or down, there's a basis state. So then this Hilbert space is just quantum spins. And the Boltzmann weight of the classical system determines the ground state wave function, and it's called a square root state because the wave function is the square root of the Boltzmann weight. The coolness is a coupling. And for example, for the nearest neighbor Ising model, classical Ising model, a Hamiltonian whose exact ground state is this state is this simple thing in terms of sigma x and sigma z. And the reason that this wave function is nice is that correlations of in the classical system are correlations of operators which are a certain set of operators in the quantum system. And the reason that this is useful for my purposes is that I know that when the Ising model is critical, when I choose the critical temperature of the Ising model, that means that these correlations are long-ranged. The correlation length associated with these correlation functions is diverging, and so that means that necessarily tuning this parameter beta through that point is a quantum phase transition. This is a quantum critical point. So in particular, it's an example of a gapless state, and as you might anticipate, I can use our knowledge of the classical Ising model to construct an RG circuit for this thing. So a real space RG scheme for the classical system then produces a quantum RG scheme. So here's the idea: we're going to use a trick, which I learned from a paper by Levin and Nave, to write the partition function of the classical Ising model in terms of a tensor network contraction. So associated with each vertex. So if I want to study the Ising model in the honeycomb lattice, I associate tensors with the vertices of the triangular lattice. I think I got that right. And write the partition function, here we go, just contract all the indices of all those tensors. So there's some explicit choice of what those t's you should pick if you want to study the Ising model. And then the nice thing that these guys did was to show a series of moves whereby the move has two steps. whereby you start with the big honeycomb lattice and then kind of deform it a little bit. So you do this kind of channel duality move where you define a new set of tensors just by singular value decomposition, which you know, starting from here, you end up, by that move, you get where is it? My picture is too fancy. Well, there's two moves. There's this one and there's this one where you, so you, after doing that, you get a triangle and then you shrink the triangle. So that's the coarse graining step. And so starting with the honeycomb lattice here, if you follow this picture, which just involves those two moves, you end up with a honeycomb lattice with fewer sites. I guess, yeah. And the quantum version of that is pretty simple. It's the following thing. Associated with each of those moves, you define a unitary operation. There's some ancillas involved at each step. So here, in fact, you need to start with ancillas, and you end up spitting out some ancillas at the end. So that, actually, this is a new ingredient in this gapless case. And then the fixed point of the classical this procedure is an S-source fixed point. This is some attempt to construct the whole layer of the whole picture, which was not entirely successful. So this is a proof of the existence of such circuits for gapless states. Okay, and then finally, in the remaining 2 minutes, let me comment that the extension of these new ways to construct tensor networks is useful also for open quantum systems. For example, because even in thermal equilibrium, so you know, you might think that in thermal physics, you know the state, you know that the density matrix is e to the minus beta h in equilibrium. There's no step of finding the ground state. What's the problem? But that second step of actually computing correlation functions is not so easy, right? So if I tell you some local Hamiltonian, I tell you the state is e to the minus beta h, compute averages, right? You can't. It's not so easy. And so that step for that reason, this is useful. And the thing that replaces the unitaries, which grow the system, is instead a channel, instead a quantum, you know, a thing that acts on both sides of the density matrix and preserves and is totally positive and trace preserving. And so there's some simple natural generalization of what an S-source fixed point is. And although the entropy can be volume law, as you might expect in thermal states, the mutual information is still of such a family of states is still area law. And so that is to say, even though the Vanoorman entropy measures not just entanglement but also thermal entropy, in thermal states, of course, it's extensive, but the entanglement can still be small, even in interesting states. And because if our channel here, if this V that we're using here has some locality properties, then this thing preserves the locality of the operators, and so therefore produces a circuit which is again efficiently contractible, and so therefore useful for this purpose. Okay, and we showed that free fermions have S equals zero in this sense. Mixed, the thermal state of free fermions can be shown very explicitly to have such a local channel that produces it from nothing. Okay, and more generally, a sufficient condition for such a channel to exist is that the entanglement entropy of subregions looks something like this. There can be an extensive term, there can be an area law term, and there can be a bunch of subleading terms. But the important thing is that these are all written as local integrals over the boundary of the region, and everything else has to decay exponentially in the size of the subregion. And if this is true, and it's true of many states, then the system is an approximate quantum Markov chain. Right, so we can go home because Fauzi and Renner proved that when this is true, you can make a channel with the properties that we want. So approximate quantum Markov chain means that this conditional mutual information is approximately zero, where approximately zero means that only these terms vanish, and so they go away when we consider regions that are big compared to the correlation length, when this exponential is small. And so this leads to a procedure where basically you should think of what we're doing as making a cellular decomposition of space. So you start with, you chop space up into a collection of sites, and then you try to glue together those sites by introducing cells associated with links. And then at the next step, you add cells associated with the faces of the lattice. And then in three dimensions, you have to add cells associated with the volumes. And at each of those steps, there can be an obstruction to doing that in a local way, which arises in this form. It's the mutual information between the P cells and the P minus one cells given these sort of buffer regions. So that these gray things are these buffer regions across which we're growing them. And then as long as that thing goes like this, which is true, given this assumption about the behavior of entanglement entropy of subregions, then this is the state. Then these people show the existence of a channel which does what we want. And when is this condition satisfied? It's satisfied for invertible states, for CFT at finite temperature, for states with gravity duals, and basically the only states at finite temperature for which it's not true are finite temperature quantum memories. Dum, dum, dum. I should have had some music there. So a finite temperature quantum memory is a highly desirable thing. It's a thing which stores quantum information even at finite temperature. And known examples of them are only in four dimensions and higher. If you find one, you should tell people. We've given some evidence that there's a close connection. The only examples we know of states which don't have S equals zero in the sense are ones which are finite temperature quantum memories, like two-form gauge theory in four dimensions. Okay, so I'll skip this comment about the bubble nothing array. And finally, this construction was used in this recent paper maybe make is too strong a statement, to argue for efficient representations of non-equilibrium steady states, which are associated with stuff moving around with currents. And the idea there is that even though the von Neumann entropy is extensive, that they have some tensor network representations, and this kind of construction shows that efficiently contractible tensor network representations can be made. Okay, so there are a few questions which maybe I'll skip. The channel that Fauzi and Renner guarantee us doesn't incorporate all of the information. There's some reason to believe that we can make a better circuit than their theorem guarantees. And then finally, as I tried to emphasize, a strong motivation for doing this is that the structure of entanglement determines the geometry of a dual when it exists. There's this slogan. I tried to convince Brian that the slogan was valuable, that variations in distance are related to variations in entropy. It's a very simple way to remember the form of the metric in emergent geometries. But actually, it turns out that and so in this talk, I've been kind of talking about this step of this procedure, where starting with a quantum many body system, you figure out how to make such a network. And then lots of people have done a lot of work to show that from there, Einstein's equations kind of come out. This slogan, actually, it seems like it's not true in the sense that there are some examples of holographic geometries we know where time is the emergent direction, like behind a black hole horizon. And there, it seems like we need some extra information, not just about the entanglement between subregions of the state, but also about the complexity of the state, which is a much more horrible notion. And this some unification of these ideas is required in order to resurrect this slogan. And a picture that I would like to advocate in that direction is to think of the channel, the unitary, which is whose complexity is indicated here, as in this way, and then think about entanglement of subspaces of that, and maybe it's possible to resurrect this important but not quite true equation. Okay, so that's the end. This is a classification of everything according to its value of S. if you know a state of matter which isn't in this table in spirit, tell me, please. And particularly if you disagree with anything in the table, please tell me. Yeah.
Is there anything about non-Fermi liquids?
Yeah, so that's here. Oh, non-Fermi. That's it. Okay. Yeah, so that's here. That's here. Yeah, that's really what I mean by that. So maybe there's a question mark there. I think this we're sure about. Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that all the non-Fermi liquids I know just have an area law violation. Have a log. Area law violation.
Okay. What's one star?
What's one star? Let me try to remember why we put that star there. Goldstones. Is that right? Yeah, I guess. I forget why we put the star. There's some Goldstones. There's some... I'll tell you later. That's everything, right? There's nothing else, right? Just... Okay, that's the end. You can stare at the table at your leisure.